And really, I feel that when we get into desire and the exploration of desire, it's actually infinite. In the sense, it's one of the mysteries of human existence. We will never get to the bottom of it. It will be amenable to being opened up from, I don't know, maybe countless directions as well. We're just touching on three directions today. Three, if you like, spokes of a wheel into or out of desire. So we hoping that each one kind of opens it up in different ways. And depending on your background and the kind of teachings that you're familiar with, or the tradition, spiritually or otherwise, that you're familiar with, each one will open up in a different way or sound very different to what you've heard before, or in conflict or whatever. In a way, I'm meaning to open things up. I mean, a lot of that depends on your background, what you've heard and what you're familiar with. And part one is, it was already quite big, but part two, and I'm going to be a little unfair here, I'm giving myself 3 minutes for part two, and I'm going to dangle something a little bit tantalizingly in front of you and then take it away. partly because it's important, very important, and partly in order to kind of balance out what else we're saying today a little bit. But I want to spend most of the time dwelling on reflecting on something else. So we said this morning, it's actually impossible, no matter what one's heard, it's actually impossible to be in the world of things and move in the world of things and objects and events, to be in that world free of desire is actually impossible. It's a fiction of a notion. However, as a meditative practice, letting go of desire and taking that as a kind of meditative avenue is extremely powerful and takes one extremely deep. And so this is what I want to touch on, is that it's really something to point you in a direction if you're interested in exploring this. And if you are, it's something I've certainly talked about a lot at different times, and I can point you to recordings on the internet, etc., if you want to explore this avenue a bit more. I feel it's very implicit, it's present in the classical Buddhist teachings, but it's not given much attention these days, and it's kind of certainly implicit there and actually explicitly in a few places. I'm really talking about a practice, a meditative practice. We're not even touching on it here today, I'm just talking about it. It would start with learning to become, in meditation, familiar with how it feels to desire something, to want something. And desire can work both ways. In other words, I might want to get something that I don't have, even if it's just a pleasant feeling in meditation. I might have a pleasant feeling and I might want to hold on to it. Those are both movements of desire. I might have an unpleasant feeling and I might want to get rid of it. That's also a desire. We call it aversion in the Dharma, but it's a kind of desire. So it could work in any of those ways, but they're all kind of the movements of desire. And getting familiar with that as an experience. What does it feel like to have that movement in consciousness at any time? Now, sometimes obviously it's gross, relatively gross. The mind is screaming, I want this, I need to get rid of this. The thought is involved, etc. It's clear. With meditation, taking it as a theme, the awareness can become more and more subtle, that we're actually noticing, picking up on more and more subtle desires. The first thing is to become familiar, but then to let go of this desire, to find ways of relaxing the clinging, the craving, the aversion, the desire. So getting familiar and letting it go. And what happens if one takes that as an avenue in meditation? Well, after a little while of doing this, one will report that there is less suffering in that time. It's a conspicuous decrease and draining out of the suffering felt in the moment, of any dis-ease felt in the moment. Do you understand? When any kind of discomfort or dis-ease or suffering, it will be lessened to the degree that one lets go of the clinging, of the push and pull with experience. Is this making sense? Yeah, and that's almost like it's just a universal law, pretty much. That's the first thing. And there's already a very important insight there. Most of the suffering we experience in life comes from the relationship that I have with something, not from the thing itself. I could have a backache or whatever it is. If my relationship is one of pushing away, there will be suffering in that. When I let go of the desire to get rid of, the desire to change or whatever, the suffering drains out of the experience. The suffering is in the relationship and not in the thing so much. Make sense? Yeah? I need to see this, I don't know, 10,000 times. I might understand it, but I need to see it 10,000 times and feel it. And this is why it's a meditative practice. Feeling in the body, what does it feel like to desire? What does it feel like to have that sense of dis-ease? What does it feel like, the release from the dis-ease? And feeling it in the body over and over. This is what clinging feels like. This is what release from clinging feels like. Suffering, not suffering. Suffering, less suffering. Over and over and over, till it's literally imprinted in the cells, that insight, that wisdom. Very important. But, and that's wonderful, that's absolutely wonderful, and the whole relationship with life begins to be seeing things differently. But I can't sustain, as I said before, can't sustain that non-arising of subtle desire. I can't sustain that in my life. It's impossible. It would be a silly thing to even try. The practice, the meditatively, doesn't stop there. I'm watching my 3 minutes here. It goes further. If I keep doing this, not only do I see less and less suffering, and of course with that more and more openness, more and more well-being, more and more joy and peace come, as I'm doing this meditatively, not only will that deepen, but other curious things I will notice. The sense of self, the sense of me being something separate from the rest of existence, will correspondingly, what should we say, fade, dissolve, get less sense of something solid, independent, separate. The very sense of self begins to quieten, to dissolve, to open up. The habitual sense of me being separate from everything else, that begins to bleed out. The sense, not only that, but the sense of substantiality of things and of experiences, as if we're in a world of real, solid, independent things, that also begins to open up, to dissolve, to fade. So much so, as one takes this more and more deeply, more and more subtly, with more and more sensitivity, letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go, that actually it begins to be that all experience begins to fade. All perceptions or all experience begins to fade. It just gets more and more, or less and less and less, if you like. Appearances themselves begin to fade. And this is just what happens if you do this. It's a law of consciousness, if you like. What on earth is going on here? What is happening there? And I can have a room full of people and I get them to do this and they come back in a week or so on retreat and I say, I bet you're experiencing this, 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 and they, it's a law of consciousness. What does it mean? What's the implications of that? One could say, well, obviously you're doing something weird with your brain biochemistry and it's not, your brain's not working properly, it's not processing. But really, all I'm doing is sitting there, being present and letting go of desire, letting go of clinging. Something here is of the most, you could say, the deepest significance in the Dharma, the deepest thing that the Buddha was pointing to is being pointed out in that unfolding of that kind of experience. Something's being implied about the nature of reality and the nature of perception. Something, it needs to be understood, that brings the deepest freedom. There's something huge there, but I don't want to dwell on it today. What I do want to go into is something, in a way, even more puzzling than that, more puzzling to me. But as I said, I wanted to teach in a different way today. So rather than the usual sort of ways of saying stuff. Can we enter a slight fantasy now that I'm a research scientist, and I've done some research and I want to present some findings to you. Is that okay? So, and why can't you also be a research scientist? In other words, every time one sits down to meditate, you're a researcher into consciousness. A researcher into the nature of mind and the nature of experience and all of that. Why would one not look at oneself that way? It's okay? Mm-hmm. So, different role. And again, to me it suggests a lot of questions that are not so easy to answer, in fact. So something happened, and there was some difficulty going on actually with the behind-the-scenes politics at Gaia, of course I'm involved with there, and it was quite a difficult situation. It was kind of weighing on me in quite a difficult way. And I felt like I stumbled on something in meditation, and I can't actually remember the details of what was going on or exactly how I did, but I knew that I stumbled on a kind of principle. And so I started trying it out with students and people I was working with, and getting them to approach things in a different way and see what would happen. So as I said, what I want to do now is kind of present case studies, if you like, which are really, these are real things that happen. Protecting the anonymity of the people, but it's the real case studies, if you like, of what happened when people approached something in a different way using desire. And I hope that through sharing these with you, you'll understand what I'm getting at in terms of the principle, and I'll try and make it clear in that way. So as I said, I can't remember the details of what I was going through. I'll start with someone else. And a student, and I was working with her on the telephone interview. She had had an experience, I can't remember exactly what it was, and it involved going into a bank, and there was some kind of problem in the interaction, and something happened, and there was a big hassle in something about her money, and it was very frustrating. And she found herself really upset by this, the way she was treated and what happened, and how what she needed from the bank didn't happen and all that. And she said, no one said sorry. No one said sorry. And she was quite upset still about this. Now, from a traditional, and some of you will know, from a traditional Dharma practice, we could say, okay, here's this thing happened. How can we approach this in a way that relieves some of the suffering? Now, some of you will know there's loving kindness practice, where you bring the intention of kindness to yourself or to others. So one could have approached that situation like that. You're feeling hurt, you're feeling angry, let's bring some kindness in to care for yourself, to care for the bank manager and whoever it was. That would be one approach. Another approach would be, and again some of you will be familiar with this, is can you see it, and we say, as not self. This self is an illusion, we say in Buddhism and other spiritual teachings. Can you see it? And she was an experienced practitioner, able to work with that kind of practice. So rather than the self getting, or the ego getting pumped up in this situation, can you actually drop that ego? See the self as illusion, and it opens up the whole situation. We could have done that. We didn't do either the metta or that. Another thing we could have done is, can you explore these feelings that are coming up? And we talked a little bit about this. There was a sense of helplessness, that she was helpless to do anything in this situation. There was a sense of grief at not being taken seriously by the officials in the bank. There was a sense of not being respected. Again, one very viable and important avenue would be to explore those feelings, hold those feelings, care for them, meet them, embrace them, etc. And then out of that, is it possible to be with, in this case, there was felt like a hurt little girl inside. She was in her 60s actually, but inside is a hurt little girl, and that little girl feels helpless. And can you relate to her yourself with compassion, with care, with warmth, with love? That would have been beautiful and viable. All those three would have. We did something else. We said, okay, this anger and this frustration and all of that, what are you wanting? What are you wanting? Or you could say, what is this desire wanting? Now, when I put that question to her, and of course this will happen to everyone, so you say, you have that question, and immediately the head comes up with answers. Well, I want this or that. I want this or that to happen, X or Y, to happen. Or we feel the lack. Someone just suggests something about wanting and it goes immediately into a sense of lack, and Ramiro brought this up this morning a little bit. We feel the lack in the desire. I want this, but I don't have it. And I feel the not having of what I want. And in a way, the desire is stuck on this or that that I want, and I end up feeling the pain of the sense of lack. So that was initially what happened. There were these head answers. I said, can you actually, what happens if you come and feel the energy of that desire of what you're wanting? You feel that in the body, and don't assume, really see if you can kind of sweep aside the assumptions that what you might want is bad or immature or wrong, etc. And really feel the energy of the desire in the body. And she did that, and then what happened actually is a sense of empowerment came, which was very interesting. A sense of empowerment, and she felt like that there was the ability then to say something and to stand up. She actually had to have more interactions with the bank because of this. There was the ability to stand up and say something to the bank manager, etc., and the bank clerk. In her words, there was the possibility of a creative response came with that. And with that included was a feeling of strength. She went from a feeling of helplessness to a feeling of strength. Not just helplessness and lack. So, okay, very good, very good. And I said, that's great, can you go back to the feeling then and really feel this feeling again and really open to it? And really allow and open to that movement of energy in the body without landing on an image of an event or an action that you want to happen that comes from the mind. So really allowing the energy in the body of desire here and really open to it and allow it. And allow it to fill the experience, to fill the sense of the body, and move, and really give it space. And this is all on the phone. And then she actually tried that, and she said, and then what happened when she did that was a whole sense of energy came into the whole system. She was extremely energized, and she said, it's like dancing. I feel like dancing. There's this dancing energy in my body, and a whole other level of strength came in. A whole other level, a sense of openness came. And love came. And love was one of the answers that she'd given originally to the question, what am I wanting here? I want love. There was a sense of an absence of love. At that point, there was no sense of lack, and actually quite, not overwhelming, but a very intense sense of abundance. I think that's pretty interesting. Another example. I was talking with someone else, and this is in a face-to-face interview, and she was starting a new romance, very, very lovely, and she'd met a man, but he lived in California or somewhere, and but they'd been to, he was over here for a while, and they'd spent an extended period of time, and he went back, and she was going to go and visit him. And she said she wanted to talk. I want to talk about craving, because I'm craving, and I feel that the craving is painful. I feel the craving is painful. I feel it's a contraction. It feels like a contraction. And also noticing with the craving that went with this wanting to be with him, there was fear of loss as well. So the whole territory felt contracted, wanting something in the future, somewhere else. And there was the fear of loss, that it's a new relationship, it might not work out, and the fear that there would be loss and it not working out. Now again, one can approach it in more traditional ways. And so more from a traditional Buddhist perspective would be like, well, what's craving? Let's look at this craving and why it brings suffering and how it works. So I would say craving, from this perspective, involves what I would call hype, okay? In the sense that to really fall for something, it needs the mind to hype it up in ways. And the mind constructs, if you like, an artificial distinction between things and times. So they seem very different. The sense of difference between here and now, and then and there, gets artificially differentiated. It seems so different. In her words, the adventure begins then, when I get to California. That's when it's going to be alive. Now, she said, it just feels like waiting. It's like limbo. I'm in limbo. Even though there was a lot of lovely exchange now, and texting and speaking on the phone. But then the question, from this more traditional perspective, a really valid avenue, really important to be able to work this way as well, is it really that different? Is it really that different? Here, now, and then, and there. Is it really that different, or is it the mind making it different? Yeah. So we say in Buddhism, I have here, right now, wherever I am, I have the experience of sight, sound, taste, smell, and touch, and thoughts, and mental experiences, and body, and feelings, and all that. I have all that, what we call the five aggregates and the six sense doors. I have that here, and I will have that there. And there will be sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and feelings, etc., all there and all here. And they're not that different. There'll be colors and forms and feelings and nice emotions and not so nice emotions and pleasant sights and not so pleasant sights. But the mind is coming in and hyping it to create this differentiation. Do you understand what I mean? Yeah? So that's a really important way of working, is like cutting the hype, seeing that there's hype involved. Less hype, where you see through the hype, less craving. Hype is like advertising, it's like spin, market, pumping something up. You understand? You make something look in an unreal way more attractive than it is. You're creating it, yeah. Like, I really need this because it's very different than what I have now. Yeah? Yeah. Less hype, if I see through the hype, less craving. Less craving, less hype, it works both ways. Okay, so that's valid. But again, we didn't work that way. Well, we mentioned it, if I remember, it a little while ago. When I said, in this other mode, I said, what are you wanting? What are you wanting? There's this craving. What are you wanting? And first thing, so I want him. It's obvious. Dumb question. I want him. And it's hard at first to see any deeper than that. It's just obvious. It's obvious what I want. I want him. So we explored it a little bit. And then she said, what are you appreciating? What are you loving there? She said, I love that I can say anything and I'm listened to. And that was her words, what she loved in this beginning exploration. I love that I can say anything and I'm listened to. And again, taking that a little bit deeper, like, what are you wanting here? And so I want, and these are her, and she kind of outlined some things. I want what I really want is the opening of the heart. That's what I'm really, it's not so much him, it's I want the opening of the heart. I want the expression. I want that expression. I want the connection and the being received. And I want to love. So these, if you like, are more general, deeper wantings than just this or that person. Do you understand? This or that object. Do you understand? Deeper qualities. And we could say the desire then is not landing on something so limited as an object. Does this make sense if I say this? So can you feel that? Can you really feel into that and allow that? And then she began to do that, and again she said it felt like a current inside her, in her words, deeper and more powerful than she was used to, and was affecting her very sense of self as she opened to it. She said, this current feels deeper and more powerful than who I usually take myself to be or who I usually feel myself to be. So it's usually a whole level of desire that one wouldn't let oneself go to. And in experiencing it, in opening to it, it opens up the whole sense of self. And that's was working with this. Can you let it fill the body? Can you allow it and really feel it and really give it space, etc., as I said before? And then she said, doing this, and she was able to, actually, it feels like the boundaries of myself are dissolving. It feels like the very sense of, like I don't have any edges, and there's a whole expansion of the sense of self, a whole expansion of the sense of being. And at that point, she got a little bit afraid. Losing my sense of boundaries, something is really opening. I mean, it's a deep and beautiful experience, but it was a little bit fearful for her. And so what are you afraid of there? And she said, oh, I'm afraid of losing myself. I'm afraid of disappearing. Actually, what happened in this instance is we ran out of time in the but, you know, one could then bring compassion to that. Compassion to the resistant self. Compassion to the self that's a little bit afraid of opening beyond its usual boundaries. And very normal to have resistance and fear with that. Playing with one's edges there. But eventually, and whether this is slow or fast, one would be able to allow that expansion as something extremely lovely for a human being. The sense of self opens out from just this little box enclosed here that ends there and is different from everything else. So precious for a human being for that to dissolve and open out and expand. And then there's a whole new sense of self and life force that goes with that strength, openness, and actually independence. So not being so dependent on this object of desire, that object of desire, because I have something here, and something opens out here. And in a way, fulfilled doesn't close us off and make us kind of aloof, but something is being fulfilled to a great extent by, what could we say, that life force opening, by the deep desire flowing. So I had a question, or I have a question. Is it possible that this sense of craving that we all know, a sense of craving that feels contracted and painful, with the swings, as she was talking about, it swings to this fear of loss, and it swings, if it's relationship, it swings to this fear of rejection, just starting a new relationship, maybe he won't like me, maybe it won't work out, maybe this or that. That kind of craving, the kind of craving that repeatedly moves away from the present moment, gets lost in the future and in daydream, that kind of painful craving, is it possible, that kind of contracted craving, that kind of contracted craving might actually be a result even of not connecting to, not realizing and not allowing deeper desire to unfold, to be felt and to flow? Is that possible? Is it possible also that there's a habit of feeling desire in a certain way that feels pained and contracted? Another example, I'm just walking us through examples to paint, outline what I'm trying to communicate. A guy I was working with in an interview, and he was asking a lot of questions about his direction in life, and again, a feeling he really wanted to give in service, and service to the Dharma, and all kinds of things. But he also was hungry for romance, and he wanted a family, and he was alone, and he didn't have the children, and he wanted that. And he feels that as a deep current. So he feels pulled, not sure what to trust in himself, and all this. And again, starting with, what if, and he's a long-term Buddhist practitioner, what if you just literally sweep off the table the assumption that desire is wrapped up with the self's wants and therefore is something untrustworthy, what we call in the Dharma kilesa, kind of impurity. You just wipe that off and look at it afresh. Wipe the assumptions off the table. Maybe even, what would happen is, as an experiment, you actually put in a different assumption there, just as an experiment, and assume instead that my movement of desire or aversion, whatever it is actually like a plant's movement towards the sun. What's that called? Phototropic. You understand? There's something intelligent, if you like, in the very movement of desire, rather than it being something that one is not to be trusting. What if you assume that? So one actually trusts this dynamic intelligence in that moment of the life force or whatever. And he did that and working with it. And then what I want what I want is love. And he meant giving love and receiving love. And there was this real sense of opening to that, and again, in the body very much involved. But as he did that, open to it, again, no sense of lack in that desire, in that movement. It's a current of the being or the life force, whatever you want to call it. And he, again, felt very physical, felt in the front of the body, something completely opening up with it, and actually, eventually, it just opened up to the whole body. Opened up so much that it felt like whatever this was, this sense of energy, was actually bigger than the body, and the body was inside it. The thoughts were inside it, the whole life was inside it. And again, like we said earlier this morning, what then if the practical choices came out of that? It's a very different relationship with the whole thing. Someone else, again, it's like, had felt like they were feeling or noticing at times beautiful qualities of the heart arise, like curiosity, wonder, or excitement. And they were doing a lot of work, they're a long-term Buddhist practitioner, and they were also working in parallel with a kind of shamanic tradition, they were working with that. And here were these lovely qualities. Notice that whenever they came up, they squashed them. They squashed the excitement. Excitement somehow wasn't allowed in the being. Wonder and curiosity, and it kind of got squashed a little bit. And the explanation was because of past hurts and trauma, difficulties in the childhood, that the energy was repressed and held back and constrained through fear, etc. And so he said, I feel that when I was a child, I was told, you're too much. Your energy is too much. Lid it, put a bottle on it. And that he internalized that, and that's what he kept doing to himself, with all the repression that involved. And this other shamanic tradition, and like would be many psychotherapeutic ways and other teachings might say, you need to go back and identify the causes of the patterns in your history, and so to speak, and this is the language, dig out the root. And when you've dug out the root of that repression, then the beautiful qualities can manifest. And that's completely true and completely valid. Well, it's not completely true, but it's true and valid. And there's another approach too, which we're going to talk about. Also possible to feel into, in this case, the frustration at repression. Feel into that energy and the desire involved in that. And again, what's it wanting? What's being wanted here? And again, similar thing. Feeling it in the body, and the qualities then manifest with that, of what one's wanting. And the sense of self itself opens and changes. And he said that the sense of self opened in a way that he began to feel power in him, but not power over, just power. He felt powerful. And he said, I feel different. I feel a freedom in this now, in this sense of self, compared to the usual distorted, kind of repressed, inhibited, habitual sense of self. There's something that maybe in the desire, in the frustration, in the aversion itself, may well be the seed or the seeds of what we're looking for. Which to me is very curious. It's extremely curious.
Paradox.
Yeah, exactly.
Something very. There is a solution, you are saying.
Something very curious is going on here. In the desire, the frustration, the aversion itself is the very seed of what we're looking for. If I approach it in the right way, that which I am looking for can actually manifest, curiously. Those qualities here and now. And with that, open up the sense of self. Now I'm thinking of other examples here. This is a very experienced practitioner, a young guy. He's very, very bright as well. Very bright, very dedicated practitioner. And he noticed in his, I don't know if he was meditating or something, he noticed images and sort of little brief fantasies and desires even of appearing certain ways to other people. He said, I noticed this was going on, that I want to appear bright and insightful and creative and virile and kind of dynamic and noble and kind of fearless in my exploration, all that. And at first, of course, he was suspicious of this, that this looks like ego. You know, I want to appear fantastic to other people. This can't be trustworthy. And at first, indeed, the me, the self, was tied up with it. It was. Wanting to appear a certain way. But being with it, he let himself explore it. And actually, he realized it wasn't so much about the self. It was almost as if realizing the qualities themselves of brightness and everything else that he was talking about, those qualities are beautiful qualities. And it's almost like wanting them to appear. It wasn't so much about the self. It's almost like wanting them to manifest in the universe. Does it make sense if I say that? I want their beauty to be seen and even to be appreciated. It's not about me. There's a sense of the universe, you could say, from one perspective. The universe unfolding these qualities through time. It's not about me. And as he let himself experience that, there was a whole sense of vastness. Again, the sense of self opened. That was very different. Very different than me and an ego that wants something. And he felt a much bigger, much deeper sense of me. In a way, there was really not so much self there. It was as if these qualities belonged to the universe and not to the self. Actually, one can go beyond that too and not even identify a universe, such go beyond the emptiness of that. So we often assume, and this relates to something, what's your name?
Me?
Yeah,
Lee.
What Lee said, touched on this morning, is we assume that desires are from the self, and the self and the desire are intimately related. We assume that. Or that desires will feed the sense of self, the sense of ego. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe it's not so simple as all that. If I share something from my experience, in the last few years I've been studying a lot more than I ever have in my life and all kinds of things, and one of the things I was studying is is modern physics, just as much as I can understand it, because of its relation to the Buddhist teachings of emptiness. There's a lot of crossover there. So I was studying a lot, as much as I can understand, and I'm really hungry to understand. And after a while, you know, I'd read this book and I would go into this book, and then I felt a kind of impatience with the process. It's like and that impatience was becoming familiar to me. There was a kind of pressure on understanding. And it's almost like you read one book and you finish it, and basically it just leads to another book. And kind of, well, that leaves me with more questions. So I chase this, and that leads to another one. And I'm unable to read them fast enough. And I want to arrive at the end. I want to arrive at, I understand it now. I can just put it down and be finished with it. No more books to read. No more to study. And I fell into that, and it's like, and again, what's it wanting? What's being wanted here? Actually, there was a kind of openness to the joy in ongoing inquiry. So it wasn't so much about reaching an end point. Actually, this sense of it's beautiful to just keep inquiring, keep discovering, keep questioning. There was something in that. It was actually very, very lovely. It opened up a lot of beautiful joy. And again, the sense of self opening up in different experiences and perceptions and levels there. Two more brief examples. Someone I was working with, this is on the phone again, had an ongoing situation with her sister, the sister was struggling a lot in all kinds of difficult life situations and not really dealing with those situations and those challenges very well at all. Really, not doing very well with them. And my student there was really, really concerned and worried and having really struggling over her, in her love for her sister. And there was a lot of pain in it for her, really quite a lot of pain and torment, seeing her sister go through this and feeling like she wasn't really open to suggestions or being helped, or couldn't, she felt powerless in relation to it. And again, it's like, can you feel what you want for her? Can you feel what you're wanting for her? Can you really let yourself feel into that? And very similar, like we were talking about what we did before. And what happened was it reconnected. It's like tenderness came into the experience of the love. Trust came. Love came and peace came. Rather than worry. What's the difference between compassion and worry? Well, actually, compassion doesn't have worry in it. It's more steady. That it moved the whole loving to that, rather than being fraught and painful. And she says she felt reconnected to her strength, able to access her strength, herself, her sanity, the spaciousness, through the desire, through going deep into opening to the desire. Someone else, last one, and this is a curious one, was reporting, I feel this ongoing resistance to life. I feel like I'm just resistant to life. And what do you mean? So, well, part of it, I feel resistant to other people's suffering. I just feel like I want to block it all out. And so you can go in via the resistance. What is that resistance wanting? What is that resistance wanting? Now, we might think it's resistance, exactly what you said, I want to keep all that out. You might think it wants to be unhassled by it all. I want to be not troubled, not impinged upon by all the suffering in the world and around me. Not have anything penetrate that way. But actually, going into it was completely the opposite. It was not that. Rather, it was to open the desire, as access through the resistance, asking what does this resistance want, was actually, I want to open, to engage, to meet life. And in feeling that, the desire that was wrapped up in it, was seeded in the resistance, actually openness came. Really increased the sense of openness, and the sense of resistance just drained out and bled out. So there's actually a ton more examples, of which I'm just sharing some of them. And I went through a period where I was just trying it a lot in all kinds of different situations with people. So much so that in about 98% of the cases, this is what was happening. And I felt like I didn't even need further proof. Something was here, and it was happening, and it's like, okay, it's pretty clear now. To me, this is very, very interesting. It's puzzling, and something is happening here. That's not immediately obvious what's going on. Let's put that aside and come back again, just some reflections. What is the relationship with desire? What is my relationship with desires? Complex. Why do I have the relationship that I have with desires? Where does that come from? Just something I've heard, some teaching? My past. If I go back to that, what I described in the morning, and there was that student who told to the other teacher of her longing for God, and the teacher said, oh, that's just craving. Well, it may be, you know, that teacher was actually, she was adopted as a young child, and a very difficult childhood. With that, and I wonder whether it just wasn't okay. It's not okay for her to desire. It's not okay to want deeply. So this might apply to me. This might apply to you. Is it okay to desire deeply, to want deeply? And if you go back to the child, the mother, the breast, love, attention, whatever it is, father. And out of that, I'm not saying it all comes from early childhood and family. I'm not saying that, but could be some. Fear of desiring, fear of inhabiting and allowing desire in life, because one is afraid of disappointment, afraid of humiliation, afraid of punishment. And then how easily, wherever that comes from, whether it's cultural or whatever it is, how easily then one co-opts spiritual teachings on no desire and letting go of desire. And I know, and I know others know, later in life, if that is the case, one can actually re-experience the frustration, the deep pain, primal desire, etc., and see that it's okay, really see that it's okay, and there can be a healing there. It may be that one needs to grieve what one didn't get, and something can open and move on. This, what I've described in part three, in this way of working with difficulties when they come up, it may be that one needs to actually grieve the sense of lack in the present, of what is lacking in the present. It may be that that is a kind of precursor, I don't know. But be careful, and there's a real caution, because, as I mentioned, it's so easy with desire that we get stuck in the sense of lack in relationship to desire. That's where the mind goes, and that's where it gets stuck, in the sense of not having. Desire and lack may go together, may be intertwined. And if it gets stuck there, then our experience of desire will actually be predominantly an experience of lack, which is painful. Does it need to be that? If it's been the habit, if I've been accustomed to noticing and feeling lack whenever I have a desire, if that's where the mind always goes, that's where the attention always goes, then discerning and tuning into and allowing desire may feel very unnatural. It may feel like this is a strangely artificial move. It may feel like I'm making something happen here. It may feel like the lack seems like what is actually present, what is natural, what is unforced. It may seem that way, but what in there is just the illusion of habit, a habit of attention, a habit of constructing something rather than another thing. And then it feels, for all the world, like it's natural and untampered with, but it's just the habit of creating that. There have been, just in however many times I've tried this with people, there have been a couple of instances where it didn't work. And one instance was where someone in the interview was like this, as we were talking and engaging and everything. But I would actually say body posture is quite important with this. If I'm like this, it might be that the usual, what should we say, psychophysical circuits of energy and mind, etc., they're the ones that are getting, that's where the energy is flowing, just in the usual circuits. And those usual circuits may well be, if one is like most people, may well be the circuits of lack, of despair, etc. Desire, if we're talking about the way we're talking about today, actually has a lot of energy in it. And I might need to sit upright and have the body be open in order that it actually open to that flow. And if I'm like this, just the habituation of the body kind of conditioning the mind and the consciousness, it will condition it in a habit of going in not so much energy, in the sense of lack, in the sense of futility, etc., weakness. So I need an open, upright posture to allow that fullness. I've been wondering, for what does this need? And I don't know how it sounds. You know, maybe it sounds like, well, this is all really advanced. I don't know. Or, I could never do that. I don't know. None of those examples that I shared with you, none of them came from people on retreat. None of them. Not one. So it wasn't saying, well, I'd have to be really mindful and really sensitive and really quiet to be able to do that. Not one of them came from a person on retreat. They were all people living very busy lives in the middle of their busy lives. Usually though, as I said, lack and desire are usually intertwined, and usually we get frightened or pained by the sense of lack mixed in. But maybe it's possible to differentiate the lack from the desire and actually unfold it out. Maybe that needs more subtlety of attention. I don't know. I'm questioning. Is that what it needs? That the attention is subtle enough to separate them? Maybe both the sense of lack and the sense of desire need exploration. And it's not just one or the other. And I said, maybe I need to feel the lack first and then open to the desire. But I wouldn't even assume that. I wouldn't even assume that. Maybe I don't need to feel the sense of lack first. I'm just so careful with the assumptions we have around everything. So I ask myself out loud, what is needed? Because no one who I've shared this with has then come back to me at a future occasion and said, you know that thing we did on the phone? Well, I've been trying it on my own and this works. And that's partly to do, I don't know why that is, it's complicated. But I wonder what's needed. So now they had someone helping them, guiding the awareness instead of helping them work through it. But it may be, as we're talking, separating out the lack, feeling the grieving, or all that, it may be that it needs a kind of facility with one's emotional life, a capacity of navigating, you know, the different emotional states. It may be that it needs that. It may be that it needs the previous practice of being able to let go of desire and trust that and feel it's okay, or at least to feel desire and know it, familiar with it. Feel safe having it, feel safe letting it go. Maybe it needs that. I doubt that it would, I mean, in fact, I know it for myself because I did it with myself. I know that it wouldn't always need someone else there helping you through it, guiding you through it. No way. Maybe it's complex, maybe it's difficult, maybe it's advanced, but I don't think so. I don't think so. So, to me, it opens up a lot of questions. And especially if you're familiar with a classical Buddhist background, you might be like, I don't know how this fits in now. It's not obvious how that fits in. It's very hard. I mean, I could just about make it work, but I'd have to go quite deep and da-da-da. So it depends, as I said, depends on your background, whether this is, you know, what impact this is having on you. We might have to go to the tantric teachings. And I wouldn't want to just equate it either, but there's a goddess, a deity in the Guhya Samaja Tantra, Buddhist Tantra, Ragarati, her name is. She, that's her mantra actually, she who delights in lust.
Lust?
Lust.
Lust.
Yeah, she who delights in lust, Ragarati. She's a mantra, her name is Pandaravasini. She's a version of Tara, if you know anything about Buddhist Tantra. Her realm is the realm of warmth and fire. There's something there, it's pointing to something. In the Jewish Kabbalah, the mystical teachings of Judaism, there's a phrase, we need to dare to extract the sparks of divinity, the sparks of God, even and especially from those states of mind and heart that seem completely removed from God. Here's this anger, this aversion, this frustration, this bloody-mindedness, this lust. Seems like it has nothing to do with anything spiritual. And saying, maybe right in the middle of that, something can be redeemed of the divinity, if we use that language there. Friedrich Nietzsche said, ultimately, one loves one's desires and not that which is desired.
Great.
So where's the treasure? Where is the treasure? We'll have time later if it's okay. I just want to. Where is the treasure? In the object of the desire? Or in the opening that comes from the movement of the desire? If I can do that really deeply. It's a habit of humanity, of ignorance, if you like, to keep expecting the object to give the fulfillment. Even after we've experienced something different, like what I've described in this part three, or part two even. Even after that, I keep wanting the object to give me something. Because that's a habit. And as I said, no one's yet reported to me, I did this again on my own, I followed it up. Just to wrap up, part two and part three outlined briefly methods and approaches that you could take. To me, number two takes you incredibly deep. Number three is to me very interesting. What's going on here? At the very least, methods and approaches. So I hope it doesn't sound abstract what I'm talking about today. This is actually our life and ways we can work with it. It's not abstract. I'm talking about practices and what ways of engaging. So there's that. Wanting you to to give you methods and approaches that are not abstract. But as well as that, I think the intention really today is maybe to plant seeds, to plant some seeds of questioning that might open something up in areas that may be not so open in terms of our assumptions and our inquiries. So it might be that today feels like, I don't know, didn't really get much from today, didn't blah, 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 blah. But if all it's done is plant some seeds and they begin to sprout at a future time, that's good. I actually think what's being touched on today is huge, and it may not be that one realizes the relevance or the significance of it today. In a way, that's fine. That's fine. There's an enormous amount here, just what I've kind of gone through just today. There's a lot here. I would say what I said right, I think right at the beginning. If something I haven't said so far today, if you haven't been surprised or felt like your understanding or your views are stretched, if there's nothing new for you here, something's gone wrong. It's probably my fault, but something's gone wrong. There's going to be something in there that's not going to fit a view that you had. Something surprising. And it might be uncomfortable, it might be disconcerting, it might be puzzling, it might be exciting. I would hope that it's exciting. Inquiry is interesting when we inquire, because one also has to be honest that sometimes we're looking for certain answers. I think I'm inquiring into life and into myself or into this or that, but actually I want the answer to be this or that. And it's good just to be aware of that. What do I want to see? What do I want the conclusion to be? So I'm going to stop there.